This episode is brought to you by Fume. Don't give up, switch up. Take the bad out of your habits and get into what we like to call the good habit. Start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/dark and getting the journey pack today. Fume's giving listeners of the show 10% off when they use my code DARK to help make starting the good habit that much easier. Start the good habit at https://tryfume.com/dark to save 10% off the journey pack today.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 24. And yes, we've come once again to the final episode of this season. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Nikki Exposito, Dominic Eagle, and Seth Paul. Tonight we'll hear stories of deadly disappearances, inhospitable houses, and mines of mayhem. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Yes, as Season 14 draws to a close, what better way to end than on the end itself, as we look into those who just can't seem to let go of the land of the living. We all wonder what goes on after we're no longer here, but take heart, because as our stories this evening will demonstrate, for some of us it's going to be nice and creepy. Nikki Exposito leads our trip into the afterlife with a story of an accountant who just found out he has more work to do after the star accountant takes a new job, and right in the middle of the busiest time of year. But is it all it appears to be on his social media feeds? Without further ado, I present to you, I'll Kill You After Tax Season. Some places you expect to be haunted. The Hollywood apartment building where I live with my girlfriend, built in 1935, with a creepily out-of-tune piano in the lobby, definitely playing host to a spirit or two. The respiratory hospital, once an insane asylum, my grandmother died in. Basically a malicious presence, Hilton. Murder houses, old churches, my Pasadena elementary school. All ghost catnip. You know what isn't supposed to be haunted? The sleek, modern office building in Century City where I work. Finished in 2019, featured in Architectural Digest magazine. The Century Premium Business Complex is a glass-walled marvel with state-of-the-art security, a private underground parking lot, and an elevator system designed to streamline employee access. The business management firm where I work as a staff accountant, Jorgensen Goldberg Slady, rents out the entire 12th floor. Unexplained supernatural crap shouldn't have existed within miles of the place. But then again, plenty of things shouldn't exist. The water's in the bathroom. Still off, right? Keegan asked me. Christ. They couldn't have picked a better week. I looked up from my computer and nodded. The bathroom in the lobby is open. Screw that. I'll just go down to the 11th floor. Keegan strode off, and I didn't give his potty problem a second thought. He was right. Remodeling a business management firm's bathrooms the first week of March, when every accountant, tax accountant, is neck deep in corporate returns for our clients' many, many loan outs, that has to be a breach of someone's code of conduct. At nearly 10 at night, Keegan and I were camped, still, in the tax office. Management said I wasn't allowed to call it the tax hole. Keegan, the firm's rising star, had buried himself in the cooked books of a new client's monumentally screwed charitable foundation. I, less shiny than Keegan, was trying to wrap up a complicated LLC, and my balance sheet hung off balance by $63. 45 minutes later, I found my mistake. I flipped a 6 and a 9 and straightened up from my monitors to realize that, curiously, Keegan still hadn't returned from the restroom. His screensaver bounced. His Red Bull lingered, forgotten. Was he constipated, I thought? Or maybe he decided he'd hit his daily quota for staring at wonky charity books and decided to go home after his trip to the John. Whatever, I hit my daily quota for staring at K-1s. I shut down my computer and decided I'd talk to Keegan the next day. The next day, though, Keegan didn't come into work, or the day after that. I texted him, he didn't respond. I asked co-workers, they had no idea what was up with him. Finally, on Friday, after no sight of Keegan for nearly 4 days, I consulted Matt, the tax partner. Keegan quit, Matt said plainly. He got a new job. He emailed the partners. That's bullcrap, I said. It had to be. For starters, no accountant quits a job or finds a new one in the middle of tax season, and especially not an accountant like Keegan. Keegan was a company man with a capital C and M. He'd started as an intern at Jorgensen Goldberg Slatty his junior year of college and gave no indication he wanted to leave ever. He actually said he intended to make partners someday. Quitting in the middle of the night on March the 9th definitely wasn't consistent with Keegan's brand. I'm serious, Matt said defensively. I can show you the email. He clicked on something and beckoned me to the side of his desk. Keegan's resignation email was open on his monitor. Matt, Kevin, Liz, Andrew, and the rest of the JGS team, I apologize for the late notice, but I won't be returning. As of tomorrow, I've accepted an exciting new position at a higher salary at a competing business management firm. Thank you for the professional opportunity you allowed me, and best luck in the future. Sincerely, Keegan Rains. As I read, my low-key concern for Keegan dissipated, and blind fury boiled up to replace it. The asshole quit with zero warning, and since I was the only other tax department junior accountant, he'd essentially guaranteed all his work would be dumped on me. Classy move, dickhead, I texted him. After tax season, I'm going to kill you. For a while, I didn't think much about Keegan. I mean, I didn't forget about him. I remembered I had a work buddy named Keegan Rains and that he'd quit without notice. And whenever I was assigned a new mammoth tax return marked up with Keegan's notes, I'd shake my fist at the sky and curse him. But the unsettling weirdness surrounding his disappearance ceased to bother me. Until late May. On my way into the building as I waited for the parking lot sensor to read my security placard, I watched a tow truck drive in the opposite direction out of the lot toward the street. The total blew onto Civic with a Cal State Northridge bumper sticker and a Playa del Rey surf decal on the back window. Keegan's car. All of a sudden, clarity knocked me down like a tidal wave. Keegan vanished weeks before, in the middle of the night, after going to take a piss on the 11th floor. He never answered my texts or calls. He'd quit by sending the partners a short, odd email that sounded like it was written by a cheap AI. And apparently, his Honda had been parked in the building lot since then. No one else in the office shared my concern. Are you sure it was Keegan's car? Matt said. There's a lot of Civics in the world. Do you really think he's the first employee to quit at an inopportune time? Lisa, the senior tax accountant, droned boredly. It's not like he's in any actual danger, is he? One of the bookkeepers said confidently. Haven't you seen his Facebook account? I hadn't. I log on to Facebook about once a year to respond to happy birthday messages from my aunt and my grandparents. But social media was an avenue I hadn't explored yet. I did follow Keegan on Twitter and Instagram, and both accounts, I soon realized, had been deleted. I typed Keegan Rains into the Google search bar on my phone, and a Facebook page popped up. In his profile picture, Keegan, with gelled back hair and a sterile smile, posed in front of a blurry, indistinguishable office building in a sport coat and striped tie. The photo banner was a photo of the Los Angeles skyline. The education section of his profile listed a bachelor's in accounting from Cal State Northridge. No employment information. I scrolled down. His entire wall seemed to be a series of generic quotes, the type you'd see on a corporate pamphlet. Do or do not, there's no try. Yoda. The losers sit around and cry about the injustices done to them. Winners turn those injustices into fuel to ignite the fire within. They sleep. We grind. Useless wannabe inspirational crap like that. Keegan had created the page recently, on March 10th, the day after I'd last seen him. New job, new Facebook profile. The first post was a photo, taken in a bright restaurant with exposed brick walls and blue flowers, of Keegan and a woman. The woman was slender and willowy with long red hair and wide-set blue eyes. At Lola Trattoria, with Bay, the tag read. Bay. New girlfriend too, apparently. Keegan had had a girlfriend, I remembered. I met her at a couple office parties, and she definitely wasn't the woman in the photo. The girlfriend I'd known was short and round-faced, with glasses. The chick in this Facebook picture? I couldn't put my finger on it, but she was wrong somehow. Like one of those cursed images people put on Tumblr. The longer I stared at her face, the more uncomfortable I became. I went through Keegan's friends list instead. It was short, only 31 people, and it was odd. Not odd because I didn't recognize any of them. Plenty of people don't follow their coworkers on Facebook, but because they all seemed so random. Like there was no one from Northridge or the Jesuit high school Keegan attended, or his surfing club, or his amateur photography meetups. Just a series of moderately attractive young professionals from an assortment of cities. Stephanie, a junior advertising executive in Minneapolis. James, an intellectual property attorney in New Orleans. Adriel, marketing manager in New York. Rick, software engineer in London. I logged on to my own account and sent Keegan a friend request, then put the strange Facebook page to the back of my mind and focused on work. It wasn't until later that day, as I headed down to the lobby for lunch, that the most glaring oddity of Keegan's disappearance knocked me upside the head. He said he was going to the bathroom on the 11th floor. The way the elevators are programmed in our building, you need to scan an ID card. My ID card, Keegan's card, the card belonging to anyone in my office, only got us to our office on the 12th floor. I couldn't, say, pop into the ad agency on the 15th floor unless someone who worked there called down to security and explicitly requested I be allowed up. Then, security could program me a temporary badge. But even if Keegan had managed to game the system or obtain a temporary badge, he still couldn't have gotten to the 11th floor from ours. You see, different elevators are programmed to go to specific places, and ours was programmed for the 12th to the 18th floors. So if Keegan wanted to go to the 11th floor, he'd need to take the elevator back down to the lobby, then get on a second different elevator, which seemed like a lot of effort for a quick pee. Maybe he'd gone down the stairs instead. I tested that hypothesis that afternoon. I entered the stairwell through the emergency exit at the back of my office, and I clambered down one set of fire stairs to a platform, then another flight, and another platform, and a third flight, and another platform, this one with a push door. The door was unlocked. I shoved my way through it and into the West Coast Life insurance lobby, face to face with a pissy-looking receptionist. West Coast Life Insurance rented the 10th floor, so the stairs just skipped the 11th. "What do you want on the 11th floor?" the tired-looking security guard asked me, a suspicious frown on his face. I smiled at him placatingly. I started, "How would I get there? To, like, use the bathroom if I needed to." "You can use the bathrooms in the lobby or the parking lot," he replied sternly. "There's nothing on the 11th floor." My eyes involuntarily twitched toward the guard's own ID card, sitting on the desk by his computer. I knew, and he knew I knew, that security staff's cards function as master keys for the elevator, able to override the system and access any floor. "There's nothing on the 11th floor," the man repeated, nearly snarling. "You don't ever need to go there. No one needs to go there." This episode is brought to you by Fume. Look, folks, there are just some habits that are hard to break. You know, they're bad for you, but when you finally decide to tackle them, they just seem insurmountable. It's like climbing a mountain wearing a t-shirt and flip-flops. But maybe the problem isn't the mountain, it's the tools you have to get there. Don't give up, just switch up. Let Fume be the step you take to get into the good habit. Let me take a moment and tell you what Fume is not. It's not an electronic box. It's not loaded with a bunch of vapors that'll make your mouth feel sticky and gross afterward. What it is a diffused air device, handsome, rugged, made of wood and metal with a smooth finish, and I can tell you it has a nice balance and feel. Just load it with one of the many fresh-tasting flavored air canisters, and I think with one or two breaths, you'll find it a much fresher taste than what you may be used to now. And now, with the magnetic stand and two models to choose from, your journey to a better habit can be comfortable and stylish. So take that first step. When you switch to the right tools, that mountain ahead won't seem quite so daunting. And it just might be fun, with Fume at your fingertips. Start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/dark and getting the journey pack today. Fume's giving listeners of this show 10% off when they use my code DARK to help make starting the good habit that much easier. Start the good habit at https://tryfume.com/dark to save 10% off the journey pack today.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
Some people, a switch just goes off in their head, said blonde, dimpled lawyer Kyle. Like lemmings, but instead of jumping off a cliff, they quit their job. My girlfriend, Tara, is an entertainment lawyer. Before you ask, yes, she makes considerably more than I do. But she's got 3 years of USC law school loans to pay back. My accounting degree from night school, which I bartended to pay rent, after it became apparent my dreams of success as a movie stuntman weren't going to pan out, had been a considerably less hefty financial investment. So, for the moment at least, we're equal. She works in Century City as well, a couple of blocks from my office. On summer Fridays, we do happy hour at one of the neighborhood cocktail bars. I brought Keegan along a few times. That day, though, it was me and the lawyers. I used to work as an in-house counsel for a marketing firm in Manhattan, Kyle continued. This smoking hot blonde chick worked there, Adriel. At the firm Christmas party, she said she was going to an empty office to call her boyfriend. None of us ever saw her again. But she's alive, right? Tara cut in through sips of her martini. Kyle nodded. Yeah, she's still on social media and everything. She just cut and ran, stopped talking to everyone at work. Even the other chicks she was real tight with. No idea why she did it. She was like the partner's golden child. If she wanted more money, I'm sure they would have given her a raise. The topic of conversation shifted to a married client's affair with a pool boy, but Lord Carl's words bounced around in my head. Blonde, Adriel, the missing Manhattanite yuppie. Her story was disturbingly similar to Keegan's. Beloved employee gone in an instant with no explanation. Adriel made a call in an empty office. Keegan took a piss on an abandoned floor. But also, I knew Adriel, or at least I knew where to find her. On Facebook, on Keegan's friends list. As soon as Tara and I returned to our apartment, I logged onto Facebook. Keegan had apparently rejected my friend request. I found Adriel's page, Adriel March. She was, as Kyle reported, a pedestrian, pretty blonde, with dimples and a nice ass. In her profile picture, she lifted a green cocktail, smiling saucily. Her banner, like Keegan's, was a cityscape, New York instead of Los Angeles. BA in Marketing Management from Barack College, employed as a marketing manager at Yellow Flower Media. Her profile was littered with self-important, rise-and-grind quotes, a dash of lean-in corporate feminism sprinkled over the top for flavor. She said she could, and so she did. Most girls dream of marrying the smartest, strongest, richest boy. I'd rather be smarter, stronger, and richer than all the boys. Her profile was older than Keegan's, and she'd posted more pictures. Her sitting with a Ken doll-looking man at a trendy sushi restaurant, grinning, ready to run the New York Marathon. More colorful drinks surrounded by an interchangeable herd of inoffensively pretty blondes. Leaned against the railing, East River behind her, Manhattan skyline, beyond the river, arms wrapped around a skinny redhead with wide-set blue eyes. Bay, I recognized. Keegan's girlfriend. Adriel tagged her by name. Rosalie Drawn. Sight of the girl, Rosalie, gave me the same unsettled, indistinctive gut kick she had before. It was her eyes, or her alien skinny arms, or the drape of her red tank top. Something. What sort of name was Rosula, anyway? I clicked out of Facebook and onto Google, Yellow Flower Media. If I could find where Adriel worked, then I didn't know. A few pages popped up, a couple LinkedIn accounts, including Adriel's. Next, I found the Yellow Flower Media corporate website itself. For a marketing firm, their site was, well, forgettable. It was as though they'd gone out of their way to make their internet footprint as drab, dull, and generic as possible, from the off-white background in Times New Roman font to the links that didn't work, to the About Us section, which consisted of a single, barely readable paragraph. Something about ROI to drive content engagement with search engine optimization through business-to-business synergy in the brand space. It read like the work of a chatbot with Tourette's. With a sudden burst of inspiration, I pulled up the Wayback Machine. I searched for Yellow Flower Media, and in a second I had a hit. Yellow Flower Media was a marketing firm in East Midtown Manhattan. They'd worked with internet startups in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then permanently closed in 2005. That Saturday, I drove to Fairy Tale Cafe, a Koreatown coffee place, with big tables and comfy chairs to study for the CPA exam. It was something I needed to do, study, take the exams, get certified. I'd been procrastinating because everything associated with the CPA exam was about as interesting as watching grass grow. But I needed a break. A break from disappearing blondes and ghost marketing agencies, from Facebook and creepy Rosalie Drawn, from Keegan's old clients and Keegan's empty desk and just Keegan. I couldn't deal with how much space the guy took up in my head. In line for my coffee, though, I was rudely reminded of how I knew about Fairy Tale Cafe in the first place. Keegan took me there once. He lived in Koreatown. It was Keegan's face I found myself staring into, his photograph printed on a flyer pinned up on the cafe's community board. Missing person. Keegan Rains, 25 years old, 5'10", brown hair, hazel eyes. Missing since March 10th. I felt like a 100-pound baseball bat hit me square in the chest. I nearly sunk to my knees right there, overcome with both vindication and abject terror. I wasn't crazy or exaggerating. Keegan had gone missing under suspicious circumstances. There was a number on the flyer. I sat down at a table and dialed it, and a young woman answered. I saw your flyer, I started weakly. I was a friend of Keegan's, and I think we should talk. Do you know the Fairy Tale Cafe? Stupid, of course, you know it, that's why the flyer's there. Give me 10 minutes, the woman cut in, and then hung up. 10 minutes later, a young Korean woman with a round face, curly hair, and glasses walked into the Fairy Tale Cafe. I waved her over. I knew her. She was Keegan's girlfriend, or ex-girlfriend, Lauren. Laura? You're Frances, right? She asked as we sat down. I remember you from the Christmas party. Yeah, I said, and you're Lauren? Leslie, she corrected. He wanted to talk about Keegan. I saw him that night. He said he was going to the bathroom on the 11th floor, and then he was gone. Even in my head, I sounded like an idiot. But Leslie stared appreciatively. So you were the last person to see him? I think so. Keegan had been off for a while, she explained. It started small. She'd find him, staring, unblinking, into space for minutes at a time. Then those stare-at-nothing attacks began happening while he was driving. He'd miss a turn or a freeway exit on a road. He'd taken so many times, muscle memory should have kicked in. The two of them liked trying new restaurants a couple times a week. For these outings, Keegan began suggesting random places he claimed his friends recommended. Leslie would Google the name and find out Keegan's suggestion was a restaurant shut down long ago. Some were relics that hadn't been opened since Keegan was a small child. Next was movies. Keegan would throw out a film title, again a recommendation from a friend or co-worker that didn't exist. Or sometimes when Leslie would search for a movie, she'd find it had been a project a famous actor or director had been attached to, then abandoned. We got together in college, Leslie told me. We were supposed to get engaged this year. Then he stops answering his phones and responding to texts and sends me a 6-word email. I think we should break up. Does he have any family? I asked. Only child. Mom died last year. Doesn't talk to his dad. If he has any grandparents or cousins or aunties, I don't know. Did you see his Facebook page? I ventured. She nodded. He's got a LinkedIn, too. Apparently he's working for some business management firm called Crowley Wilkes & Company, with no address, no phone number, and no online reviews. He writes like ChatGPT got drunk and tried to mimic white guy who works in an office. It's not him, Francis. Someone is pretending to be Keegan online. AI, or a Russian troll, or the redhead, I offered. Leslie stared at me, eyes wide and wild. Like I said, that isn't Keegan in those pictures. It can't be. My Keegan's gone. Leslie and I didn't have much more to say to each other, so I went home. I logged back into Facebook and opened Keegan's page. He'd added to it. A few more generic motivational speaker quotes and some photos. Whoever Facebook Keegan was, he knew enough about real Keegan to recreate his hobbies. A whole series of shots captured Keegan at the beach with his surfboard. In one, he and Rosula Dron posed with their arms snaked around each other. Again, Rosula's wrongness hit my brain like an off-key note in a song. My breath caught in my throat. I figured it out. One of Rosula's slender, pale, freckled arms was wrapped around Keegan's waist. Another slender, pale, freckled arm terminated in a dainty hand clasping Keegan's chin. A third slender, pale, freckled arm clutched a yellow surfboard. Either this chick had three arms, or she'd been poorly photoshopped. Her eyes were two-dimensional. Her shadow went the wrong way. In one bikini shot, her belly button was missing. Whoever or whatever managed Keegan's Facebook page, Adriel March's Facebook page, and all their friends' Facebook pages had an uncomfortable stranglehold over information on the surface web. Utilizing Wayback Machine, though, I found traces of the people they used to be. I uncovered an old Instagram profile belonging to Stephanie, the junior advertising executive from Minneapolis. Before her posts abruptly stopped in 2019, she shared photos of her ugly dog and thoughts that weren't yuppie cliches. I dug up an old cooking blog she kept as a side project by James, the intellectual property attorney in New Orleans. The last entry, dated 2020, detailing James' adventures making sourdough bread, had 56 comments. All some version of, "Where are you, man?" Or, "Please call me, sweetie." Or, "I just want to know you're alive." A missing persons report had been filed by the family of Rick, the London software engineer, back in 2015. Crowley, Wilkes & Company, an LA-based management firm, shut its doors permanently in 2011. Lola Trattoria, the aesthetically pleasing Italian restaurant where Keegan posed with Rosella, went under in 2009. Suddenly, a Facebook message popped up, catching my attention. A direct message from Rosula Drone. "Want friend?" I was seized by burning panic. "Who are you?" I responded. "Want you my friend?" "Where's Keegan?" I typed. "Keegan mine. Mine, mine, mine. You my friend? Will you be my friend, Francis?" My stomach hit the floor. How did she know my name? I closed out of Facebook and turned off my computer. I needed answers, and I knew where I needed to go to get those answers. It wasn't really an advertisement for building security, just how easily I snuck past the night guards. I cased the joint for a few days. After 8, only 2 security guards watched over the lobby. The east side security guard kept his headphones in and his eyes down, only looking up in response to footsteps or voices. The west side security guard, a guy about my age and my build, always came up with a big thermos of coffee and between 9 and 9:30, retreated to the bathroom for 10 to 12 minutes. The next Friday, I ducked into a stall in the men's lobby room. I waited there until I saw the black slacks and shined shoes of the west side security guard in the stall next to mine. Then I threw on a black jacket, the same style the security team wore, and sauntered confidently to the west side security desk. The east side security guard barely glanced at me as I snatched up my west side security guard's key card. The electricity was out on the 11th floor, but the glass walls allowed in all the moonlight and streetlight I needed to find my way around. Over the reception desk, metallic letters, CWC, still hung. The office layout mimicked mine, mostly open plan, with glass-walled private workspaces for seniors and partners. I got the impression whatever business once rented this place had left in a hurry. Boxes of file folders rested in collapsing pyramids and piles, around overturned desks and picked-apart electronics. A thin coat of dust rested over everything. I looked down and saw a trail of shoe prints. I followed the shoe prints past scattered plastic flowers and busted printers and crates of unopened mail and dried-out highlighters and metallic file cabinets, empty, drawers still hanging agape. Then the prints stopped. It took an earth-shattering minute for my brain to process the thing in front of me. A body. A human body. Eyes, decomposed, skin leathery and brown, like a prop mummy at a haunted house. Long yellow nails, lips, dust, nose, teeth, burrowing maggots, patches of curly brown hair, khaki pants, green shirt. Keegan's green shirt. Keegan, Keegan, Keegan. Beyond Keegan, there were more. The second corpse had been reduced to a gray husk, the dirty white skeleton of a third sprawled between desks like discarded debris was all that remained. "Did you find what you came for, Francis?" chirped a female voice, like a robot on an answering machine. I spun around. It was Rosula. Rosula loomed over me like a monstrous, ill-proportionate cardboard cutout. nearly as tall as the ceiling on stick-thin legs. Her wiggling arms nearly brushed the ground, red hair, an unmoving mold, long fingers too long. A toothy smile cut across her two-dimensional face. Her eyes bulged like a squeezable toy, morphing and twisting and flattening, flickering and glitching like a demented hologram. She reached for me. I turned to run and felt my feet stick to the floor. It coated the scattered documents, the abandoned desks, the forgotten office supplies. It dripped from the ceiling down the glass walls, pooled on the floor. A shimmering, gelatinous substance, the color of spit, the consistency of maple syrup. It throbbed. It gathered itself around the three bodies, hugging them, engulfing them. It reared up in little tendrils like a curious nest of snakes, tentatively sniffing me, sensing me, figuring me out. The substance sparkled, jittered, like it was something it couldn't be, pixelated. Then I felt warm, breathing ropes wrap themselves around my ankles. I wasn't built to work in an office. I was supposed to be a professional stuntman. I jerked, kicked, and twisted my body, breaking away from the pixelated jelly's grasp. It hissed. I whirled to face Rusula. Eyes red, teeth bared, she lunged at me with her alien hands. I dove, I rolled between her legs, and I ran. I ran for the emergency exit and burst through the door, tearing apart plaster and plywood, and threw myself down the fire stairs. Stairs, platform, stairs, platform. I ran and ran and ran, not pausing, not thinking, until I felt the warm summer night air on my face. Outside the Century Premium business complex, I collapsed into the grass, coughing and panting and sobbing. I lay on the ground until I'd regained enough of my reality to realize I needed to get myself up and go home. I sat and stared back at the sleek modern office building. Through the glass walls, I saw faces. Rusula shifting and flickering like a low-budget cartoon. Keegan, Adriel March, all their Facebook friends. The passably pretty, stolen young professionals gone forever from our world, trapped perpetually in that colorless, pixelated slime. They didn't look unhappy. I should have quit my job, now that I'm aware of the otherworldly horror that exists just feet below me. If I were smart, I'd never set foot in Century Premium Business Complex ever again. But why? That predatory, gelatinous stuff kidnapped yuppies from London, New Orleans, New York, all sorts of places, all over the world. At least here I know where it lives. I've been doing some reading about pocket dimensions. I don't pretend to understand the physics, but getting my head around the concept has allowed me to come up with a theory of what exactly I faced down on the 11th floor. The shimmery living gelatin that comes from a pocket dimension. Or it is a pocket dimension itself. Whatever. One way or another, it collects things from our dimension. Non-existent movies, shuttered businesses, closed bars and restaurants, and sometimes people. People like Keegan. And it either keeps them as pets or consumes them for energy. Given the quick decomposition of Keegan's body, I'm leaning towards the latter. The internet is an interface with our dimension. It might use social media to stalk targets or to lure them in. Or else Facebook and LinkedIn are a form of camouflage. If Keegan is still posting on Facebook, then he's still alive and well, and we don't have to look for him. Therefore, we don't find the living goo on the 11th floor. Places like the 11th floor are portals, maybe, between universes. Or a colony. Or an outpost of sorts. Rusula is its avatar. Like the photos it creates and the written language it produces, Rusula is a lousy forgery. She resembles a human being, just not quite close enough. She didn't want me. It wanted me. It seeks out the cream of the crop, only the best employees. Except now, I think I impressed it. Lately, I've caught myself staring into space, imagining happy hour cocktails at Lola Trattoria, recalling that hilarious story Adriel told us, considering which movie I should recommend for Keegan to see on Friday with Rasula. Then I remembered Lola Trattoria is closed and Keegan is dead. Some places aren't supposed to be haunted. Some things shouldn't exist. And some people were never meant to work in an office. But they are, and they do, and I am. Yesterday, I rode the elevator up to work. I realized an extra button had appeared. The 11th floor. I hope you enjoyed I'll Kill You After Tax Season by Nikki Esposito, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Nikki-Esposito. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/NICKY-EXPOSITO. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Why, I knew that job sounded too good to be true. Or maybe it's too true to be good? Wait, that doesn't sound right. Let's just go with the idea that the job is dead on for them. Yeah, that's better. While our last story didn't expect such a reception in a modern office building, in this tale from Dominic Eagle, well, I guess we get the sort of place you really expect of a good haunting. A house with an old and tragic history that's just the kind of place that kids dare each other to enter. Sounds like good, clean fun, right? Without further ado, I present to you A Night in the Hawthorne House. There's a house beyond the town, beyond all towns, beyond all worlds. The Hawthorne House. Ghost stories rarely carry much weight, but there is something deeply off-center about the forlorn manor at the edge of town. Many have doubted that, of course, but I've never met a skeptic who left the haunted place unchanged. Plenty of naysayers have come and gone over the years. They've heard the stories, and they wanted to see the house for themselves. The tales of terror are endless. Hauntings, disappearances, killings. Hawthorne House. It is a hole unfit for living things. A fractured abode housing nothing but the vile spirits and viler memories. The people of my town dare not step foot in the long-abandoned property, for it has borne witness to unspeakable events. The business of the missing girl in 1999 was awful enough, as was the story I'm about to tell. But the house wasn't content with one, two, or even three tragedies. Why, just a few months ago, there was the dreadful incident of the religious cultists found slaughtered in the upstairs bathroom. There was a time, however, that the Hawthorne House signified class and sophistication, and I would learn of that as a child whilst we were driving past the petrifying property. "I've always hated the place," I said, shuddering. "Me too," my mom agreed. "Should both mind your manners. That was my sister's home," my great-aunt Shirley said. "Sarah Hawthorne." My mother's jaw dropped, and I raised an inquisitive eyebrow. "What? Your sister died when you were young, Auntie Shirley. You're getting confused." Shirley shook her head. "Don't be so patronizing, Anna. I'm not senile yet. I know my own history. I've just never told you, that's all. Sarah Jackson, that was her name. She married Jonathan Hawthorne, and they had a child, Bert Hawthorne. He died at the age of 10, and I wasn't lying when I said my sister also died young. The boy's parents couldn't go on without him. They took their own lives. Barely 30 years of age, the pair of them. I'm sorry. Just what? Are you telling me that we're related to the Hawthorns? The family who lived in that dire place? My mother asked, practically hyperventilating. All of the horrible things that happened there? I don't even know what... Why are you telling me now? I'm not long for this world, dear, Shirley said, nodding her head at me. And it doesn't seem fair for little Johnny to think badly of his family. Think badly of his... My mum stopped, guffawing. People say dreadful things about the Hawthorns. To know that we're related to them, it's just... This is why I never said anything, Shirley sighed. I knew you'd react badly, just like everybody else in town. I just don't know how you could keep a secret, my mum gasped. Someone at school said they killed old man Dalton's brothers in the 50s. I said, is that true, Shirley? She nodded, and my mother gripped the steering wheel firmly. Enough of this, you two. Shirley, we'll talk about this later. Oh, do stop being so melodramatic, dear, Shirley huffed. They weren't the monsters that everybody portrayed them to be. Those Dalton boys killed poor Bert Hawthorne. I know the story, my mum whispered. That doesn't make your sister's retaliation any less dreadful. That conversation took place when I was only 10 years of age, and it stuck with me. I was a Hawthorne. My mom was right. It wasn't good to have that name tied to us. The older I got, the more I learned about the history of the place, the more I realized that I'd have a target painted on my back if the word were ever to get out. And one day, that's exactly what happened. Johnny Hawthorne, Samuel Gray shouted. The year was 2010. I was 16 years old, on the cusp of leaving high school. If only it had remained a secret for a few more months, I so nearly escaped the tyrant of our year. Samuel Gray, the bully who bullied bullies. Practically a boy in a man's body. You know the one. The kid who grew taller and wider than anyone else. The type of fearsome chap whose cronies remained loyal only because he was such a broad, menacing figure, not because anybody actually respected him. No. They feared him. Even my friends didn't have the courage to stick by my side as Samuel came stomping across the playground with several lackeys in tow. Is it true, Johnny? The grunt growled, grabbing a fistful of my school t-shirt. Are you really a Hawthorne? I stammered. What? How? I heard your mom talking to my mom about it. Michael Baker sheepishly said, peering around his side of the boss. I felt a little betrayed. Michael had once been my buddy. His mother and my mother were close friends. I didn't understand why he'd throw me under the bus. Then again, most children would have thrown their own mothers under the bus if Samuel Gray had ordered them to do so. Never mind that, the bully said, lifting me off the ground. Is it true? I sighed, realizing there was no use in lying. My great-aunt was Sarah's sister. Told you, Michael meekly muttered, unable to meet my gaze. So you're the descendant of child killers, Samuel asked, narrowing his eyes. I understood why he felt so slighted by this revelation. Samuel was a burgeoning sociopath, a boy setting his sights on a life of terrible endeavors. He definitely planned to be a killer with his own legacy one day. He seemed to envy my awful ancestry. The Dalton brothers killed Bert Hawthorne, I choked. Jonathan and Sarah acted in revenge. I should have held my tongue. What? Samuel wailed, lifting me higher. Are you making excuses for your child killer ancestors? Come on, Samuel, Michael said. Let's go before... Quiet, worm, Samuel ordered, and his soldier fell in line. Do you know old man Dalton Hawthorne? It's Jackson, I corrected. Hawthorne, Samuel viciously insisted. Don't test my patience. I'll only ask you one more time. Do you know old man Dalton?
Jeffrey Dalton?
Yes, I answered. He had three brothers. They walked into the Hawthorne house and they were never seen again. He snarled. Your bloodline did that. After the brothers killed Bert Hawthorne, I firmly protested, desperately trying to defend myself against the bully. What Jonathan and Sarah did was deplorable, but it was nothing to do with me. It was a tragic accident on the train tracks, Samuel growled, seemingly agitated that his intimidation wasn't having the desired effect. Then the bully's eyes softened and his smile turned wicked, as if he'd suddenly thought of the most wonderful idea. Wonderfully horrifying idea. He had. After school, we're going to go for a little walk, Johnny, he said. And don't bother trying to run. You know we'll find you. I did know that. Countless children had tried to swerve Samuel Gray over the years, and it hadn't ended well for any of them. Freddie May could attest to that. The boy was left with a limp in year 7, a limp that would stay with him for the rest of his life. His leg never quite healed properly. So when the final bell sounded at 3:30, I walked toward the gates at the entrance of the school. Pitying children watched me walk by. Everyone knew what happened. I was a dead man walking, a classmate on death row. Walking towards a bleak, almost certain doom at the hands of Samuel Gray and his begrudging cronies. Smart man, the bully said approvingly, nodding his head as I approached the trio of boys. I thought you might run. Let's just finish this, Sam, I sighed. The boy frowned. I don't like your tone, Johnny Hawthorne. Do you know what happened to the last person who gave me attitude? Gary, why don't you tell him? Gary, his only joyous, passionate disciple, grinned as Samuel burnt his lip with a match. He won't give me any lip ever again, the head goon chortled. I nodded, feigning amazement at Samuel's unimpressive tale. Where are we going? I asked. The bully suddenly put an arm around my shoulder and patted my chest. Let's walk and talk, Johnny. Walk and talk. Tell me, what do you know of your family's history? What did Auntie Shirley tell you about her sister? I shrugged as we started to walk away from the school. Just that we were related. We never really talked about it, and she told me the truth. Samuel smiled. Well, let me tell you all about your heritage. The year was 1957. Jonathan and Sarah Hawthorne brought little Bird into the world, and all was well. They were the most powerful people in the village, but they were also loved. Of course, even nice folk have haters, don't they? And the Dalton boys weren't a big fan of Bertie Hawthorne and his life of luxury. Who can blame them, really? The rich eat the poor, no matter how nice they may be. If only you were to put this much effort into your homework, I thought. The bully continued. One day, the Daltons, tired of the Hawthorns. Jeffrey, old man Dalton, was too young to play out with his brothers, but the other three took Bert in a walk. Much like the one we're taking today, Johnny. Nah, the cycle of time. I knew the destination that Samuel had in mind for us. Like Dalton had a proposition for Bert. He told the boy that Dalton brothers would stop pestering. He only had to do one simple thing. Hand over his Cartier wristwatch. Worth hundreds, perhaps thousands of pounds. The type of trinket that Jonathan Dalton could afford with a day's wage, most likely, was nothing to him. A drop in the sand. But to the Daltons, that money could have changed their lives, and Bert, the spoiled brat, refused. Samuel snarled. So they killed him? I asked bluntly. Seems fair. You know what, Johnny Hawthorne? Why don't you ask them yourself? He roared. We rounded a corner, and I found myself facing exactly what I expected to face. The horror at the edge of the town. The place our parents always told us to skirt around. Hawthorne House. Legend says that the souls of Blake, Drew, and Percy rest in that haunted place. Samuel whispered, placing his hands on my shoulders and squeezing painfully. What do you think, Johnny? I wanted to lie, wanted to tell the monster,
The ghosts weren't real. But I didn't believe that, and I seemed unable to bring my lips to utter those words. Truthfully, looking upon the crooked abode, I never felt so terrified, never felt so sure that a thing didn't belong. "You want to go inside, don't you?" I quietly asked. "Oh, not just that, Johnny," Samuel laughed, pushing me across the road. "I want you to spend the night." "But don't worry," Gary chortled, with a gormless expression. "We won't leave you on your own, you little baby." Samuel sighed as we reached the gate to the ominous house. "Yes, Gary, I was getting to that if you just let me finish, for crying out loud." "Sorry," Gary whimpered. The leader rolled his eyes and pushed the gate open, dragging me along the weed-littered path leading up to the front door. The two lackeys, Michael and Gary, followed in his hesitant wake. "You made your point, Samuel," Michael said. "Let's just go home. Johnny's learned his lesson." I expected the leader to react with fury, but he simply giggled. "Oh, it's too late to grow a backbone now, Mikey. You've already thrown your dear old friend under the bus. Isn't that right, Johnny?" I didn't respond, but I did cast a fleeting glance in Michael's direction, finally meeting his eyes. My gaze was met with a look of burning shame from my once friend. "Good," I thought. Samuel knocked on the door roughly. "Hello, ghosts and ghouls? Your grandnephew's paying a visit." Gary chortled uncomfortably. I could sense that he, like the rest of us, feared the Hawthorne house. Even Samuel Gray felt its power. The bravado was a front. When the property door creaked in response to his knocking, I saw the flash of horror in his eyes. Only for a second, but it was there. He was trying to prove something, and none of us were fooled. Still, nobody wanted to be on the brute's bad side. As dumb and cowardly as he may have been, he packed a mean punch. "You first, Johnny," Samuel said. "They're your relatives, after all. They won't mind if you open the door." I gulped and nodded, only wanting to end the terrifying ordeal. With shaking hands, I pushed the front door, horrified to find that the wood buckled and opened, needing only a delicate, unwilling push. I'd hoped it would stand firm and we could all have gone home. Instead, we found ourselves standing in an expansive lobby, illuminated by the late afternoon light of an autumnal day. It was undoubtedly a spectacular place once upon a time, but the Hawthorne husk reeked of nightmares. Residual trauma from decades of unthinkable events. It was filled with hollowness, though such a thing hardly makes sense. The wooden steps were rotten, and they led up to frightening paintings on the second floor, one for each of the Hawthorne family members. "Sarah? Jonathan? Bert?" Samuel called, giggling as we stepped inside. "Do you want to come and say hello to Johnny?" No reply. "Well, that's not very polite, is it?" Samuel huffed, sternly placing his hands on his hips. "You're the youngest member of the bloodline, the future of your family. Not by name, perhaps, but by blood. He's right here." "I've heard some horrible things about this place," Michael said. Samuel groaned. "Yes, we've all heard horrible things, Michael. Stop being a baby. Hawthorns? Are you there? You've got a limited window if you want to say hello to Johnny. Soon, he'll be gone. He'll join Bert in the dirt." Upon hearing that final line, the house shrieked in a drawn-out note, a resounding wail of disgust at Samuel's distasteful comment. The bully's face froze, much as it had on the doorway. His brash facade was failing. "Screw this, Sam," Michael whined. "I'm getting out of here." My old friend threw the front door open and yelled fearfully. Gary, Samuel, and I looked towards the door, and we unleashed similar cries of fright. The world outside had vanished. Beyond the doorway, there only lay an endless void of blackness. "What the?" Gary began. Samuel's eyes widened, and he fell silent for the first time in his life. I merely stood and watched. The existential nature of our situation finally dawned on me. I'd always known the stories about the Hawthorne house to be true. I'd always believed in ghosts, and I was about to become yet another casualty of the haunted household. A creak sounded from Gary's corner of the room, and we twisted our heads to find an impossibility. "Gary!" Samuel cried. "Where are you?" The boy had evaporated, fled into nothingness. The room was large and it had numerous doorways, but he would have heard his footsteps. He would have seen him leave the room. The schoolboy had simply ceased to be. "This is your game, isn't it, Johnny? You're playing a trick on us," Samuel hissed, lunging at me. We toppled to the floor and I wrestled with the boy, but it was far too strong for me. "You and your family of witches," he growled, before tightening his hands around my throat. "My granddad told me all about you. The Daltons were his friends, and you butchered them all." "Samuel, stop!" Michael cried as the light started to fade from my eyes. "You're killing him!" My old friend tried to pull the bully off me, but Samuel flung him to the ground like a rag doll. "Stay out of this, worm. There's only one way we'll make it out of here, and that's by ending the man witch, ending the bloodline." My head fell to the side as Samuel choked me, and my blurring eyes looked upon the paintings lining the top floor. The canvases seemed black and colorless to my eyes. I could no longer see the father, the mother, and the boy in their individual portraits, but I could see growing shadows behind Samuel. Vague, translucent shapes. With a sudden rush of movement, one of the ethereal forms wrapped itself around Samuel's arms, and he screamed as the spectral thing tore his hands away from my neck. "What the? Michael, what are you doing?" he yelled. But Michael was crawling backwards across the floor, striving to escape from the rotting spirits, the decaying, lifeless forms of Sarah, Jonathan, and Bert. Living corpses, ridding their home of intruders. Their skin was charred paper and their eyes were pits of fire. But Samuel, ever the determined tyrant, shook the father's hand away and grabbed a sharpened piece of loose flooring from his side. "I'm not dying here alone," he laughed maniacally. "You're coming with me, Hawthorne." I screeched as the stake came plunging down, but it stopped inches from my chest. Another hand was clutching Samuel's wrist. Michael had pounced forward, saving my life with less than a second to spare, and the boy offered me a smile, a regretful smile, a tearful smile, giving that the hands of the ghoulish family were engulfing him too. But he knew what had to be done. He helped them to wrestle Samuel off me. "No, let me go, let me," the bully began. With a rip like that of existence tearing itself apart, I found myself in a lightless dungeon, and all that existed in the darkness was an open doorway spilling white light through its opening. I had nowhere to go but through it. With a rush of light, sound, and feeling, I tumbled onto the Hawthorne's weed-covered front path in the early hours of the morning. A new morning, I realized. How had an entire day passed? When I scrambled to my feet, I turned back and faced the Hawthorne house. The empty, desolate Hawthorne house. Samuel, Michael, and Gary were nowhere to be seen, but I was sure for a fleeting moment that I caught two reddened eyes watching me from the darkness of the lobby. Before I discerned what I was truly seeing, the front door slammed shut, barring me from ever entering again. And I wouldn't dare. Not in a thousand lifetimes. I hope you enjoyed A Night in the Hawthorne House by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DominicEagle. EAGLE. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I would like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Yes, we're calling an end to Season 14, but not to worry. Season 15's picking up with more all-new tales to terrify you. I don't want to give too much away, but stay tuned for stories of out-of-controlled creations, cosmic horrors, and, of course, that always of pleasant stories, radiation monstrosities. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium, extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases, and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week and our brand new season, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment, and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request.
And don't forget to visit us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.